Hey guys, Tim Fitzpatrick here, and you're listening to Hey, Can I Come Over? Each week, or as often as time allows, I will rudely invite myself over someone's house, insist they make me dinner to my particular diet specifications, and force them to answer as many personal questions as I can manage. We are recording live from Columbus, Ohio today. I am currently on a mini vacation, visiting a very dear friend of mine who is the star of today's podcast. His name is Matt Record. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tim. I like how you turned on the energy once you hit record. Like, your voice went up like half an octave, and it was just like, Tim was on. He's in podcast mode now.
That's it, man. That's what actors do. It's what hosts do, you know? Mm-hmm. You can switch it on, switch it off. It's great. What's new? Hey, Ben.
What's new? In a 3-month span last year, I got married and moved to, you know, 4 states west. Mm-hmm. I started a PhD program.
At?
What's that?
Where is this PhD program?
Oh, at...
I mean, obviously I know, but all of our listeners may not.
I started a PhD program at the John Glenn School of Public Affairs at the Ohio State University. Ohio State University. You don't mess around with that. You don't mess around with anything regarding Ohio State when you're out here. Right. And they take their mess very seriously.
Can you explain to me what the V implies? Like, where did that come from?
I think it really was always just called the Ohio State University. And I think it was just a way... I remember seeing it on Monday Night Football, you know, how all the players introduce themselves, yeah. Be like, Orlando Pace, left tackle, Rutgers, where I actually don't know where he went to school.
I think he was a Miami guy. I could completely.
Yeah, that sounds more or less right. And so me and my roommate at Loyola, which is a college I went to originally and then got kicked out of, but I guess we can come back to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that for sure.
We would get really irritated that it would go to each player from Ohio State, and back in the early 2000s, Ohio State was a real power. So it was a lot of them. So they would stop with the Ohio State. And I think it's just a pretentious affectation, you know, just like, mm-hmm. Look at how cool I am, look at the school I came from. And now, the more annoying thing is now other schools are trying to jump on, I don't know, maybe like it's like the Auburn or the Alabama or something like that. There's a couple other schools that have jumped on the bagwagon.
That's terrible. Since then.
Yeah, it's not great. it is relatively annoying that Ohio, because if I could show you some of the papers I'm grading right now, like they're talking about local political problems in the papers that I'm grading. So they will talk about Ohio State, and they always say the Ohio State. It's so much so that the teacher that I was TAing for, she was starting to get to a point where she wanted me to take points off when the kids did that. It pissed her off so much. It doesn't bother me, but I do think I understand it's very, you know, right. Pretentious.
The only one I can think of that's not really, really obnoxious is when people call Miami University the U. Because it's kind
of, I think that's annoying, really? As hell. Oh, Miami is the worst. Those are like the worst people in the world.
Well, yeah, I completely agree.
Miami University is like a... Not Miami University. So that's the other thing.
Yeah.
We're in Ohio, and Miami is Miami of Ohio. That's right. The real Miami around here, which is actually a very good school, by the way. But, yeah, University of Miami is just, I don't know, it's like a college that would be made if, like, a guy who only ever watched, I don't know, Miami Vice and two other people, you know, two other cocaine dealers decided to make a college. Like, anybody from University of Miami is listening.
Sorry, guys.
I'm not like that sorry, but I'm...
don't worry. I doubt anyone from VU is listening.
VU.
This is clearly not your first foray into education.
Right,
you've been doing that a lot. What? Give me a background. Because even your high schooling is pretty interesting.
Yeah, okay. So I got picked on a lot in school, elementary school, middle school, and... my parents' business started doing a little bit better in the late 90s, and they started pushing us towards thinking about private school, and I was completely down for that. And I went to LaSalle Center, it was called. I prefer to refer to it as LaSalle Military Academy because that's what it was for over 100 years, mm-hmm. In Oakdale, New York. And I fell in love with it. I really liked it. But I actually went in at the time. It was obvious as the school was failing towards the end that they opened it up to more, you know, used to be an all-boys military school, then it became all boys military and preparatory academy. So you could either be in the military school or you could be in the prep side. Mm-hmm. And then it became, they opened it up to girls too. And, you know, so bit by little bit, they opened up population. So I actually went in prep. I was scared of the idea of, you know, I'm a fat kid, you know, I was scared that they're going to have us running and, you know, that I wouldn't be able to hold up, you know, that I, you know, spend all my time doing push-ups or getting beat up or something like that. Which is not like, I guess it's not like miles away from the reality, but it's not like, you know, it's not endless beatings and, right. and push-ups or anything. So once I got to LaSalle, I switched over to the military academy and I really grew to love it. I don't know, I guess I like the formality of it or the... I don't know, the prestige associated with it. I liked wearing the uniform. I really liked getting promotions. One of the proudest days still to my entire life was when I made sergeant for the first time my junior year. And I, because you had to, they instituted this promotion board. So you went up in competition with a whole bunch of other classmates. So it was like me against like five other guys, and that was the one that got it. So that was very gratifying.
Was that the highest rank that you had reached?
No. Actually, I remember not long after that. So sergeant is equivalent to E3. I don't know if you know military ranks.
I don't.
Yeah, so it's just three stripes. Three, I forget what they're called. Three chevrons.
Okay.
Three chevrons. And I remember one day the it was me and one other girl had made sergeant. And then the person who ran the school, the sergeant major who ran the school, he just started walking in and out of all the platoons where we were lined up. And then he came over to me. He stood in front of me and he said something, Sergeant First Class. And then he moved on. And then because Sergeant First Class is three chevrons and then two underneath. Okay. So it's basically two ranks above.
Gotcha.
It's what drill sergeants are usually Sergeant First Classes. So I remember saying to my lieutenant, like, did I just get a promotion? And I did. I got that promotion. And right before so LaSalle closed down. They announced in February of 2001 that the school was closing. So... me and two other pretty good students got this sort of lifeboat chance to go to Chaminade, which was, Catholic high school, very prestigious Catholic high school. Mm-hmm. So I left. I was up to get first sergeant, which is three chevrons, three underneath, and then a diamond in the middle, which is basically like on the company level, other than the company commander, he's the guy who pretty much runs the whole show.
Yeah.
So I was up for that, and apparently I would have made, major, which was whatever. This is not interesting, but like I would have
interesting to me.
At the school I would have made the second highest rank at the school.
Okay.
Apparently. That's what Lizzie told me. Lizzie's my sister. She was also at the school and she didn't leave. So that's what I was told, and I don't know for sure if that was true.
And then you went to Chaminade.
I went to Chaminade. Chaminade is very, very regimented. You take these classes these years, and they by rule they don't take transfers. And I guess there's a reason for that. I came in. I was taking Italian at LaSalle. I came in. They put me in Latin, which is the closest thing they had. I had already taken physics. I was taking physics in 11th grade, so they put me in 12th grade physics class. And by the time I got to senior year, I had taken all the science classes they had, but I had to take a science class, so they put me in marine biology with a bunch of freshmen. it was an odd transition. I never made a lot of friends there. I wasn't unhappy there. I was actually very happy in my life generally at the time, but I never quite fit into Chaminade. I didn't go to my prom. I'll probably never go to any of the reunions or anything. I'm happy to have gone there. And then came college. And then, so, Chaminade, if you think of, like, have you ever seen the movie The Emperor's Club?
No.
Okay, just think of, like, or even, like, Dead Poets Society, those, like, okay, sort of waspy private schools, and they're supposed to be, like, a straight line into the Ivy League.
Right.
Chaminade is that, but for the best Catholic schools in the country. For, like, Loyola, for Providence College, for University of Scranton, Notre Dame and Georgetown to a lesser extent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, not, you're, it's actually sort of a count against you if you're from Chaminade, if you're applying to, like, Harvard or something like that, but.
Interesting.
Maybe not a shot against you, but I don't think it really gets you very far.
Right.
You know, I don't think they're super interested in admitting.
Chaminade kids.
I mean, because they're not quite rich enough to be, like, that Harvard endowment type. You know, they're not, they've only been moneyed for two or three generations, usually, Irish, Italian, and they're, you know, they're all, like, politically conservative and shit, so it's not, like,
just not the Harvard type. The right fit, yeah.
I always pictured myself going to a school like NYU,
mm-hmm.
even BU I applied to, you know, one of those, I don't know, I don't even know what my thought process was back then. I ended up going to a school called Loyola in Baltimore, which was pushed very hard from Chaminade. And Loyola was beautiful. And it was a really nice campus. And the people were pretty nice. And the dorms were beautiful. And looking back, I just had a bad attitude going into college. College was going to be the thing that made everything that came before it make sense. Mm-hmm. I got teased a ton in elementary school, middle school. You know, I worked reasonably hard in high school. I went to this military school, which added all kinds of extra pressure on top of that. You know, I went to Chaminade, where I never really fit in, and I never really felt at home. But college was going to make it all make sense. College was when I was going to be among peers. And have you ever seen the movie Wonder Boys?
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. There's just a whole bunch of movies where it's just, like, smart people just sort of hanging around and doing college-y type things. Being smart. Yeah. And I really thought that's what college was going to be like. And college, at Loyola at least, and I think this is pretty true of undergrad across the board, was just a lot like high school. Mm. You know, you had more freedom, but it was not dissimilar to high school, and the students were not as mature or as smart as I thought they would be. They were definitely, and this was my biggest problem at Loyola. They were not as passionate as I thought they would be. They were all very nice, very even-keeled, not outwardly emotional people. And, if you know me, I am a very outwardly emotional person.
Yes. So, yes, I'm aware.
Have you ever been in a circumstance where just being you, you felt like you made everyone else ill at ease? Like, everybody else had, like, their hands up in front of their face and was like, all right, easy.
A little bit. Fella. Yeah, sometimes.
That's what it was like me at Loyola. Mm-hmm. My sister Jessica can attest to this, too, because she's maybe like, a half a notch more emotional than I am. And, like, she really loved it there, and she made lasting friendships there. Okay. But it just didn't make sense to me. It didn't work. I went in with a bad attitude, too. You know, I was arrogant. I didn't think I needed college. Anyway, you put all those things together, the recipe is I flunked out.
Right.
I failed out after five semesters.
What made your sister go if...
Well, I was still there when she first applied.
Oh.
And, I mean, okay. You know, like, it's a nice place, and it's a good school. You know, it's not crazy for her. For me, Loyola was, like, sort of in the middle of the schools that I thought I was really... the school I really, really wanted to go to was Cornell. Mm-hmm. I didn't get in. And so Loyola, to me, was sort of, not slumming it, but, like, it wasn't a safety school, but it was, like, a school that I felt pretty comfortable that I could get into. Mm-hmm. For Jessica, I think she felt Loyola was, like, a bigger deal. And I think she was definitely, I got kicked out probably 3 months before she got her acceptance. And she had already sent out her application, so I think that was probably pretty disappointing. But, you know, she made her own way, and she had it much tougher than me and my other sister, Lizzie, because Jessica, my family's financial reality basically crashed and burned while she was in school, so for the last, like, year and a half, she was sort of on her own.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But she made it work, and she's a super hard worker.
Yeah,
so,
and she's clearly doing very well for herself in Chicago now.
Yeah, she's in Chicago, she's a teacher in a school, and she's actually about to start graduate school at Northwestern.
Yeah,
well, yeah, next, in the fall, so.
And she's getting married.
Yeah, she's getting married in September. Jeez. She's doing that too.
I have noticed that. Just to go on a quick tangent here,
no, please.
All of the members of your family that I have met are quite outwardly emotional.
Yes.
do you guys know where you got that from? Is it your mom thing? Is it a your dad thing? Or is it something that just kind of happened that all of you guys do that?
I think it's probably both.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's always a lot of yelling, a lot of emotion generally in my house. Mm-hmm. What's funny is, as keyed up as I am and as emotional as I am, I don't think I would be near the top of the list in my family. Neither my nuclear family nor my extended family.
Even the extended ones are a little...
It's hard to describe it. Everybody's just very Italian and, like, yelly and you know, like, everybody's very affectionate. You know, I still kiss all the male members of my family on the cheek and stuff like that. Right. You know, I still hug my dad every time I see him. I hug and kiss my mom every time I see her. You know,
so the polar opposite of my family, basically,
I guess, if that's the way that they're...
we're not unemotional. Like, I'll do the exact same thing, kissing my, you know, right, my grandma, my mom and everything like that, but we're not yelly. We're certainly not yelly.
Really?
Not even close to yelly.
Well, isn't that uncomfortable, though? Like,
I think everyone just gets along, even if, like, someone is, like, holding a grudge against someone else at family parties, everyone will still just kind of let that slide and get along.
Yeah,
it might be slightly uncomfortable, but no one acknowledges the discomfort.
I'm extremely suspicious of those circumstances. I am very, I really lack guile, and I want everybody to know exactly where they stand with me at all times, and I want to know where I stand with everyone. And whenever there's a problem, I foment a conflict. I don't let it sit. You know, the second that I have a problem with something, I usually let somebody know. And this is like, this is probably coming off like, yeah, I keeps it real. Ain't nobody fucking around with me, and I don't fuck around with nobody. Like, no, I don't lack, like, I don't think I'm completely tactless, although I don't have as much tact as I should, and I don't think I'm, you know, I don't think I'm an angry person, but I am very uncomfortable with the notion that there are people around me that wouldn't like me and I wouldn't know about it, you know, mm-hmm. or that...
So you're not the kind of person to outwardly seek a fight or a conflict, but you want something, you want everything out there.
I'm a person to seek a resolution, I'm a person to quickly identify and seek a resolution to any conflict that exists already, no matter how small.
Gotcha.
sometimes there is a genuine, like, if there is a conflict between two people, on occasion, if you just let it go, it really will just go away. Mm-hmm. No one gets that opportunity with me, unfortunately. Because the only thing worse than blowing up a small conflict into something bigger than it is making a large conflict swept under the rug. You know, that somebody could be deeply unhappy with you or upset with you or angry with you for a long time. You would never know it. So, I mean, I completely allow for the possibility that that is happening with me, but... I don't think so.
And so, getting back on track, yeah. Flunked out of Loyola.
I flunked out of Loyola.
What did you do then?
If somebody were to ask me, like, what was I doing with my 20s, what I would say I was doing was my band, which I'm even as I'm saying it, I know how ridiculous that sounds. Because we did nothing. We accomplished very little.
You recorded an album with the second one.
So
and then it immediately dissolved.
Yeah, so I mean, I was working some combination of group homes or dayhab for people with disabilities, and as a real estate appraiser, or both. Basically, from 2005 when I got kicked out of school until recently.
Where did you get any particular training for these daycare for adults things?
No, they're it's really kind of bad actually, because like. I mean, I got training once I was hired, but you don't need to have any specialized degree or anything to get those jobs. They're like $10 an hour jobs. It's like, you want to apply there or do you want to apply at McDonald's? Like, you know, it's roughly the same vetting process on the way in.
So weird.
It's a good job, and I thought I was pretty good at it. But I think that there is, when you work in group homes, some people make it a long time, but I think for the most part there's this built-in obsolescence that lower level people are meant to come in, kind of work to the bone till they're ragged, and then they either quit or are fired. most people, I would say the retention rate in that field is probably 2 years, 3 years, something like that. Even my buddy Dave, who one of my best friends, Dave, was my boss at DDI, and he was like, he had a social work degree, and he was like, this is like what he wanted to do with his life, and he only made it like maybe 6-7 years before he burnt out and he couldn't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, some people make it a long way, but I mean, I think basically within 4 or 5 years you move up to administration or you find something else to do.
Right.
Because you're not given the tools to succeed. There's never enough money, there's never enough time, there's never enough resources, and there's never good enough people around to do what you need to do. But there are like expectations, you know, that these people can't be treated poorly or abused or whatever. So I think that they don't have the resources to really succeed. So what they do is basically wait for you to fail, and then you either leave or are fired.
Right. So, and then they bring in the next person.
Yeah, and then they
will flounder at the job for a little while. And yeah. Then
it's not dissimilar to what they do with my sister Jessica. She works at this school in Chicago, and it's at this. It's not a magnet school, but it's like a. It's like a private public school, sort of. She could describe it better than me, but basically. She works at this school where like less is more is just like the mantra. The students go to so much school, so many extra days and stay so many extra hours that they will have gone the equivalent of 5 years of high school by the time they leave. And it's their job to take these students that have fallen far, far behind and help them to succeed, deal with their behavioral problems. And they really don't have like textbooks or anything. Like she'll go in on weekends and like copy textbooks for the students and then hand them out and stuff. So basically like, she works these crazy hours, you know, like, especially during season, she's a cheerleading coach during the season. I think she said she goes in at like 6 and she gets home like 8 or 9 at night. Oh, so basically they just take these bright-eyed, bushy-tailed kids out of school. They just worth them to the bone. And then I guess the business model is to just replace them endlessly because, you know, I guess she's paid okay, but she works really hard for that money. Mm-hmm. And it's teaching is an emotionally draining job for those people for that work like 8-10-hour days, you know. Add another 4 hours on top of that and not really give it a full summer. And it's a very difficult job. And I guess with the job market as bad as it is, you can just do that. You can just cycle in people over and over and over.
There's always someone who wants to, you know, get their,
yeah,
you know, who are coming out of college and they just need that teaching job to get the experience.
Exactly. So, I think that those two situations are analogous, basically. Just plug and chug, and when that part stops working, you just take it out and sub in a new one.
Yeah. So basically, your 20s spent at, you know, doing that stuff and the band stuff.
Yeah,
not your first band ever, but the band that really started to do things was Nothing Plural.
Nothing Plural was the first band that I was ever in that I had a leadership position in.
Uh-huh.
I was always just the drummer before that.
Gotcha. So, and you were the guy in Nothing Plural.
I think that Gene and Fleming would probably resent that if they heard you say that.
I don't know if they're actually listening to it, but... Well, I mean, to be fair, you were the business guy in Nothing Plural. You were the one who organized practices, got shows...
I think that's fair.
Did the recording, talked to people. They wrote most of the music.
Yeah.
And that's how we met.
Yeah, that's how you and I met.
If you could just give a quick overview of the, you know, our meeting process.
So, this band had existed before I joined. It was our friends Gene, Chris Fleming, and Chris Weldon. And nominally, Chris Fleming's brother Bob played drums for them on the very, very rare occasions that they played shows.
Bob from episode 2.
Episode 2. Exactly. The band really wasn't much of anything, which most bands, like, I don't know if you're ever around musicians, most bands are not really bands, you know, there are people that desire to one day play a show or one day record but never actually get around to it.
Right.
And that's what Nothing Plural was for a long time, and the big selling point when Weldon would tell me about the band was that they had this ridiculous song with a pirate waltz in it and made him laugh, and I just sort of rolled my ideas at the entire notion. I cannot bring myself to devote myself ironically to something. Like, if the entire point of this band is, oh, we're silly as fuck, like, that is not attractive to me. So anyway, Bob was already in another band, so, you know, before long, they had no drummer. And it really goes to show the fact that they all knew me, all knew I was a drummer, had all been in a band with me at one point or another, except for Fleming, and that it took them this long to ask me really shows you the hesitance that they had of bringing me into their band, or how much they were probably right that I was going to ruin the whole thing for them.
Because you knew all these guys from
for years. Yeah.
You lived right down the road from
Weldon. I had known since I was 5 years old. Right. Fleming, sad as this is to say, I would have said that in 7th and 8th grade, he's probably one of my best friends. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Gene. That's less sad, though, because Gene actually liked me back, I think, and slipped over my house and stuff. Throughout high school, I was going to private school, so I hadn't totally lost touch with them, but I wasn't close to them anymore.
Right.
So, anyway, in 2004, the Weldon sort of floated the idea of me joining. I was like, yeah, sure, why not? Whatever, it'll be a lark. I should say we, because I was in the band at this point. We were so bad. We were so bad.
How bad?
I was almost embarrassed at how bad this band was. I was happy to be in a band doing original music. If you float around long enough, most bands just do covers. So I was happy to be in a band that did original music, but I did not dig. Like, they just were all over the place. It was very messy. Like, they just, you know, they didn't practice very much, so they weren't tight, and the songwriting was very, like, silly for the sake of being silly, and... Anyway, they played, I remember we practiced one day at Gene's house, and by the end of it, I was like, I hate this. I don't want to be in this band. This is really bad. And they were like, come back tomorrow. We want to show you this song that's in 5/4. I was like, oh, good. Yeah, let's write another little, just fuck with the time signature now. Whatever. Like, what else? What other silly little music school nonsense can we throw into it? And then they showed me the... It was basically completed at this point, but it was like this proto song called Near an Old TV. And it was so beautiful, and I loved it. The trumpet part in the chorus especially was so, like, sad and just beautiful. And all of a sudden, I was like, Whoa.
That's a lot better than the crap you showed me. Yes, I was expecting just another weird little music school experiment, but it was like this, like, beautiful flowing song. I really liked it. Mm-hmm. And so now all of a sudden I felt this, like, wow, there's, like, potential here. And we talked about playing this church talent show or whatever, and I was pushing to do more and to write more like Near and Old TV. And I really, really thought we could use a couple more members. At the time, Chris Fleming was the singer. And sorry if you're listening, Chris. Especially then, I didn't think it was
up to the... Well, if he was listening, he's not to listen anymore.
Especially then, I didn't think he was up to the task of being a lead singer. He was nervous to start with. And he doesn't have a traditionally great voice even now. He'll admit that. He has found ways to leverage what voice he does have in very interesting ways. Mm-hmm. But
it's
took
a very
him,
Tom Waitsy kind of.
I love the Tom Waitsy stuff. We'll get to that later. But I loved when he, like, when that was the direction he went with his voice. It was like,
yeah,
that was like a light bulb went off. I was like, wow, that's what he should have been doing the whole time. So anyway, I wanted to push to add a girl, ideally who would play violin.
Appeal.
Yeah, for the sex appeal, who would ideally play violin and would sing. Mm-hmm. They were resistant to the idea. I remember we talked about it for like a half hour at the end of practice one day. Gene especially was very resistant to the idea of getting a violin player. And then we played the song called Digital Prayer. And I could hear, like, a violin part during the chorus in the back of my head. And Gene said, he said basically the same thing. And so we had this, like, vague notion that one day we would get a violin player. Cut to the next week where we practice again. Gene had found us a violin player. This girl, Michelle, and she's going to show up today at the abandoned restaurant where we practiced.
Oh, boy, yeah, that place.
This 17-year-old girl he met at Summerfest in Sayville. So Michelle came, and she was, like, really into being in the band. We, you know, because if you think about it, like, in my head, it could have gone the other way, where it's just some girl, and there's these four nerdy guys in this kind of pretty bad band, like, and asking, like, this, like, pretty girl to come join our band, and she's like... Oh.
And she's 17, like, and you guys are all
22,
23.
Older. No, 19 or 20.
This is 2017.
Yeah.
And you guys
this
are
was in
4 years older than her.
Yeah, 3 years older than 17 is 20.
20, yeah. All right. Fuck.
That's okay. So,
must be teaching you math here, yeah. too, huh? At the Ohio State.
Yeah. so that... That's when she joined, I think it became a real band. And then the following summer, you know, we all went off to school. We all came back. In the meantime, I got kicked out of school. So I was really like, okay, now I'm doing the band, you know. Because I wanted to be in a real band where we really wrote music and really made something of ourselves for my whole life. And I never had the opportunity, really. And so by the time I got back, I don't know, I guess it was just infected with everybody else, too. It was like, okay, we're going to be a band now. Michelle had joined ostensibly to sing, too. Michelle was also too nervous to really sing. Like, right. It was just no real way she was going to sing. So I proposed, just out of necessity, because we don't know anybody else and we need a singer, that we have my sister Lizzie join. And then in the interim, Weldon had quit, so we didn't have any kind of guitar player, and that's how we brought you in.
Right.
Where, you know, I asked if they knew any guitar players. I said, well, there is Hardcore Tim.
You're like, oh, great.
Yeah, because that's exactly what I wanted, a hardcore guitarist in my band.
Right.
And then I was like, so why do they call him Hardcore Tim? And I say this story all the time. They say, you'll see. And then I met Tim, and he's the affable man you know as the host of this, and he's not really very hardcore.
And I showed up at the first practice, and I screwed up the song that they had taught me, and I go, fuck. And I'm like, oh, no. Oh, I'm so sorry. Fleming turns to me, and he's like, there are no adults here. We could curse. I don't know what I was thinking. Like, I guess you guys were all way older, so probably more mature than me.
Maybe.
And so, yeah, I have no idea what I was thinking. But, yeah, Hardcore Tim was a label that was completely undeserved.
So we meet up and we start practicing. We were practicing a lot. We were practicing every day, actually, for a while. And we just sort of – we played one show in my backyard. Somebody asked us to play a show off of that, and just – the whole summer of 2005, we just spent the entire summer stumbling from one show to the next to the next. And by the end, we had played like 15 shows that summer, which doesn't sound – it's not impressive at all until you consider it is a very intimidating prospect to book a show when you are in a new band. Like, mm-hmm. if you don't know anybody, if you have no connections, if you don't know what the process is like, it seems like this, like – insurmountable goal. It's just this mountain you could never climb. And so we got all these shows, and it was just, it was one of the most amazing experiences of my entire life.
And then everyone went away to school.
Everyone went away to school. So the band returns to hiatus, played a couple shows over the December break. Mm-hmm. We wrote another song. At this point, we had all of like 7 songs.
Right. Enough for a set.
Yeah.
But that's it.
We return the following summer. We all get together, and we just take a weekend. And we write songs. Everybody had like a song that they wanted to work on. And we decide, last summer was great. We're going to double down on everything we did last summer. More shows, more practice, more writing. And we're going to go on tour for the first time. I got this notion in my head somewhere in there that I should be booking all of our shows. That way all the money that I'm making would go to us instead of to some promoter. You know, it's not really that much more work. You just book 4 other bands. You know, everybody brings 10 people.
Everyone knows people who are in bands, so it's not even that difficult to
book. Yeah, so then we're going to put on shows. So that whole summer, I'm booking all of our shows, and it goes reasonably well. You know, as well as there's always going to be shows that people don't show up. Mm-hmm. And I get the idea that I'm going to do that by proxy when we go on tour, too. Tim talked about this with your... Which conversation was this? With McManus.
McManus, yeah. Yeah.
So we're going to go on tour, but I'm going to book all the shows instead of trying to get on pre-existing shows.
Right.
And so I would try to find 4 or 5 bands at each location. They'll bring out a few people, and you know, I'll pay them for their time, and we'll have people to play in front of. And it didn't work, obviously.
Not really, no.
Yeah, it was horrific. The only things in that tour that worked were playing open mics and playing on the street, you know, right. Where you had the sort of... pre-existing audience already, and you know it sort of brought to the fore all these existing cleavages in the band, you know, and eventually Tim and Gene quit, and that was like that was the end of Nothing Plural as it existed to that point. Nothing Plural continued on as a band beyond that with some new members, my buddies Luke and Dev, but it was a very, very different band. Fleming became unhappy with the direction that was going, he quit, and then as far as I was concerned without Fleming, without really any of the original members of the band, there's no band anymore.
Right. Unless you're a ska band, you can't really.
Yeah.
Which is funny because we were called a ska band actually pretty frequently.
Because people can't deal with a band that has trumpet but is not ska.
Right.
Or at least they couldn't in 2006.
Not ska or cake. So Nothing Plural breaks up.
Nothing Plural is done.
And you are just floundering. You have no idea what to do. Are you back at school yet?
No.
No?
No, I wasn't floundering per se.
Because you actually did start a band immediately after that.
Yeah, well, because before Nothing Plural had ended, Jim Robert, who is the guitar player and male singer for my current band, making air quotes that you can't see, which are useless.
This is radio, Matt, come on.
Yeah, amateur mistake. He had already approached me and asked me if I wanted to collaborate with him on what was then only supposed to be a recording project. He liked my lyrics. And he liked just having another person to bounce ideas off of, so it was just going to be me and him, and we were going to make music together. When Nothing Plural broke up, obviously, I decided that I wanted to push that further, so it just became the sort of evolutionary Nothing Plural, basically.
Right.
Where Lizzie was brought over, Michelle was brought over, and with Chris Weldon, who had once been the guitar player for Nothing Plural, we asked him to join. A couple other people in and out, and that became my band that I'm in now called Fortune and Spirits. Not short either. A couple years later, Chris Fleming joined Fortune Spirits, which basically made us back into Nothing Plural.
Right. Nothing Plural without Tim.
Nothing Plural without Tim or Gene.
Or Gene.
Yeah. For that matter. And actually, you've played several shows with us, so even totally without
so is
Tim.
He.
He's played 1 or 2 shows with us as well, yeah. So. Anyway, so that's
basically Nothing Plural the sequel.
Nothing Plural the sequel, but Fortune Spirits is actually, I mean, if you think about it, Nothing Plural barely did anything in 2004, so really, like, if you want to start... The real moment Nothing Plural started was 2005. The band broke up at the end of 2007. Fortune Spirits has been around twice as long. So, so...
That's weird.
Yeah, it's weird to think about, but Fortune Spirits was formed in 2007, and we're still going as of 2013. So, you know, as much as that, those days in Nothing Plural sort of hangs in our heads as, like, is, I don't know, our salad days or whatever, these, like, important moments, really, Fortune Spirits went on much, much longer.
Right.
So...
I guess it's, I mean, because it's over, we can look back on it with more nostalgia than
you. Well, that's the other, I think everything with Nothing Plural is painted with nostalgia. Right. I think that, you know, anybody who says, I think that Fortune and Spirits is just demonstrably a better band than Nothing Plural was. I think Nothing Plural was great, and we still play tons of Nothing Plural songs in Fortune and Spirits. we were younger. We didn't know what we were doing. Sometimes that leads to exciting stuff, but a lot of times that just leads to bullshit experiments that go nowhere, you know? And I think that that was, like, I think that was always our big problem. We were way too interested in the bullshit experiments that go nowhere and not interested enough in creating good songs. And I think that, you know, maybe in Fortunate Spares we went too far the other way. We weren't experimental enough, or we weren't hard enough, or we didn't reflect the individual member's personality enough. I controlled it too much, you know.
Depends on who you ask.
Yeah, Nothing Plural was this sort of balance of power between me and Chris Fleming and Gene Ryman, and then just me and Chris Fleming. You know, and then when Luke joined me, Chris Fleming and Luke. But there was always that give and take. Fortunate Spirits was always me, mm-hmm. you know. And that for good and ill. You know, every bad part about that band, you know, is not totally because of me, but it is by my design. And every bad part about that band is not totally because of me, but it is by my design.
Right.
So.
What are the tangible differences that you've noticed between Nothing Plural and Fortunate Spirits, besides just the approach that the bands took?
Fortunate Spirits was always more about being pretty. Mm. I always pictured, you know, the band The Birds?
Yeah.
It was like The Birds type melodies over Sufjan Stevens type orchestral arrangements. It's not that I didn't want to do interesting musical things. But I like pop music, and I like music that is pretty and pleasant, and, you know, this sounds like I'm just sort of pushing for adult contemporary, and maybe I am, but, like, you know, I thought it would be really interesting to try to find this middle ground between, like, just challenging somebody for the sake of challenging them, and just blasting them over the head with, you know, Muzak, you know, like, something that was interesting and not like what you had heard before. But also something that was not, like, trying to alienate you.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Nothing Plural was outwardly trying to alienate people, or...?
I think that the people in the band didn't care if right. we alienated people. Mm-hmm. I guess I have this very, like, need to... I'm very needy. I really want people's approval. Uh-huh. And I measure how good the music is by... how many people like it. You know, not... But, I mean, which kind of people like it matters, too. You know, the fact that... Britney Spears sells more albums than, you know, name any other band that I love. Doesn't mean that Britney Spears is better, but there is this sort of, I think, Darwinian aspect to music in that if no one takes up your cause, if no one goes out of their way to find you, if you're not anyone's favorite band, then you're probably not that good, you know? Every band that has any kind of worth should be somebody's favorite band, you know? And, I don't think that everybody in Nothing Plural was more about, what can I make that's interesting to me? Which can lead to really good music, and it did lead to really good music, but it was never my attitude.
Right.
I always thought the cohesion of the song mattered more than whether or not any one part was interesting to any one person. And
There were certainly a lot of kind of out there concepts that Nothing Plural threw out. For, like, the pirate waltz that we threw in, and...
Yeah, see, the whole thing, and I wish you could, like, play the pirate waltz was this song that came out, this part that came out of nowhere in this song. It was like this up-tempo jazzy number, and then all of a sudden it would just go... and it came out of nowhere. It was sort of funny, but once the novelty of it wears off, it's just like, it has no place in that song. There's a way to construct a song such that that doesn't come out of nowhere.
We did not do that.
It's the best analogy I can think of is, you know that movie From Dusk Till Dawn?
Yeah.
And, you know, it starts out as this, like, serial killer thriller, and then all of a sudden it turns into a vampire movie. Mm-hmm. And there's an entire population, usually of, like, nerd trolls that are like, yeah, that's awesome, you know, vampire movie now, fuck you, yeah. Came out of nowhere. And to me it's just like, oh, God. Like, it's not... Because it's not really that interesting an idea. It's just like, oh, hey, we have one kind of movie, and then halfway through, it's going to be a different kind of movie. You know, elbow in your ribs. You know, it's one of those things that maybe it sounds really funny when you're drunk or high, and you talk about, like, oh, I'd love to make a movie that just, like, stops halfway through and becomes a different movie. But then they actually did it, and it's like, okay, well, this is actually not that interesting, because most of the people who are watching it are sober. You know, like, you know, it's still not The Godfather, which was a mafia movie in the beginning and a mafia movie at the end, but still better than Dusk Till Dawn somehow. You know, it's not that these things aren't worth doing, it's that just because an idea has never been done before doesn't always mean that it's...
It's a good idea.
Not even good, just interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, there are some ideas that... You know, this is one of my favorite examples. You know the Dadaist movements in painting? Or not painting, art, generally. And they had, like, you know, they would put urinals in museums and...
Call it art.
Yeah, they didn't call it art. But it's not that it's not art, because the idea of it was, oh, we are going to outrage people with this. And I can't believe that in the 1910s, people were outraged by that. This was the era that brought us the women vote. And, you know, these were not stupid people. These were not unsophisticated people. And it's so easy for us to look back and go, like, oh, those yokels back 100 years ago that didn't know anything, that must have blown their minds when they saw a urinal in an art museum. And me, I can't imagine people didn't just look at that and go...
That's fucking retarded.
Yeah, I just roll my eyes at that, you know. Or another good analogy is there's this Onion article where Marilyn Manson takes to the streets of suburbia to try to outrage individual people because his music's not getting the job. And he's like getting up in this like Midwestern suburban housewife's face. He goes, doesn't my outfit upset you? Does this not completely blow your bourgeois mind? And she's like, no, I gotta pick up my kids. I gotta better, like... So these ideas, these like not really very interesting ideas, don't blow anyone's mind. So this is a long tangent. I don't think that's what Nothing Floor was all about, but I think we were taken with that mentality too often. Mm-hmm. Because
there was some just very good pop songs that we wrote, and yeah. Obviously because Fortune and Spirit still plays those, you know, they did have their merits.
Yeah, but we don't play "Devil in the Woods" is the name of the song that has that pirate waltz in it. You know, like. Mm-hmm. No one's ever like clamored for that song, you know. Like, you know,
except for the members of the band.
Yeah, we remember it much more fondly than anybody listening to it remember it. You know,
you still have to get me that that recording of Boxcar Moxie, by the way, because was my favorite song.
It's on Cole's video camera. So, this was a really long digression from your original. The original question was: I think that we were in a very different mind state when we did Nothing Floor. I think we were much younger. And I think that we were more experimental, and I think that led to interesting music. I think Fortune and Spirits is pound for pound better music, but it's probably not as interesting. And if somebody is listening for just something new, brand new, they've never heard before, Fortune and Spirits probably doesn't have much of that to offer, just because I'm not creative enough to make something that no one's ever heard before. I'd rather listen to Fortune and Spirits than Nothing Plural. You know, depending on the song. There are certain Nothing Plural songs that I will just love forever. I will always love Neuronal TV. Mm-hmm. I'll always love, I don't know, probably a solid half of our catalog. And there'll be a place in my heart for the other half, but if I wasn't in the band, I wouldn't listen to those songs, you know? And you're exactly the opposite. The songs that I love are not the songs that you love.
Not even close.
Yeah, so...
And that probably has something to do with the nostalgia and, you know, looking back at it and being like, hell yeah, that fucking pirate waltz was so, like, so fucking different than what anyone else was doing.
And it was.
And I thought it was really, like, and I know that you had said this before, but, like, and this sounds pretentious as shit, and I don't mean it to sound that way, but we kind of were around just a couple years too early, because we had, we had a jazz vibe, we sometimes had a folk vibe, we had a lot of really interesting different things going on, and we still had that kind of pop vibe, and with, you know, that kind of music is starting to get popular, or has become popular, with Mumford & Sons, obviously, with the folk stuff, but with Gogo Bordello doing their gypsy punk thing, and bands like that, I think we were just around at the wrong time.
I think we were around in the wrong place, too. One of the things about being around Columbus is I'm just shocked at, like, if we lived here, mm-hmm. I really think we would have at least been able to build a local following much easier. Mm-hmm. There's just, I think the biggest problem with Long Island is its decentralization. You know, like, it's big and there's towns everywhere, but, like, we never really got to play in front of new people, or it's really, really, I mean, if you think about it, like, what's the last band Long Island, not Brooklyn, Long Island, like, exported, and the last example I can think of is Taking Back Sunday, and that was
brand new
12 years ago, you know, like, 12 years for 3 million people right near New York City to not produce anything, like, and even the bands some of my friends are in, like Twin Sister, that are sort of from Long Island, they self-identify as being from Brooklyn. You know, that Long Island is just this, like, radioactive, like, thing to have attached to your band. It's not far away from New York enough to be interesting. And it's not a place like Jersey that has, like, any kind of musical history.
That whole blue-collar vibe that comes
out. I mean, the fact that Bruce, that Bruce Springsteen and Bon Jovi, who were probably two of the, I don't know, 20 biggest acts in the past 30 years, both came out of Jersey. And Long Island probably doesn't have one except for Billy Joel in the top 300, you know? Like, and Billy Joel was 40 years ago. It's shocking, really, to think about it.
Mm-hmm. So what's Fortune and Spirits kind of really doing now?
Fortune and Spirits is, to my great surprise and tremendous gratification, still going, but in this much reduced form with basically Weldon, Lizzie, and Michelle go and play open mics, and they're actually like, apparently like they're building like a little following for themselves at this bar called the Grey Horse Tavern in Bayport. When I come in, we play pretty big shows. Jim is around very occasionally, but we can sort of... Jim has been checked out on music for a long time. You know, he used to record bands and was really into being into music. He's in web development now, and he's doing a lot better at that financially. And I think he finds that more interesting now. So, I mean, he's not checked out on music, but he's, you know, he's checked out on music.
Which, in a sense, is a shame because he's really was talented. Very talented. But with that being said, I mean... We're friends with him, so
he's not dead
for that. Yeah. he's just never around.
Fleming, our trumpet player, basically informed me that he quit. Like, I mean, he didn't phrase it that way, but he's not in the band anymore.
Mm-hmm.
When I come into town, he says he's not really interested in playing shows with us. We have thrown around the idea of doing one more album, which would be tough to do, but we have a lot of material that didn't make it onto our first album.
Right.
And Fleming has expressed the possibility of doing that with us. I don't know exactly what that's going to look like or how it's going to come out, but that's so that's what's going on with Fortune and Spirits right now. I am really interested in what Michelle, Chris, and Lizzie have sort of crafted for themselves. Like, they've really changed the band in a very fundamental way, but they, like, sounds really good. Like, I've heard a couple recordings of them, and I'm, like, really proud of them.
Cool. Yeah. So at the very least, something's still happening.
Yeah, it's not dead, but I mean...
An hour drive away.
We're transitioning into a different part of our lives. Weldon's fiance, he's pregnant. Lizzie has a 4-year-old, my goddaughter. You know, Michelle's got like a real job with like a real salary and everything. Like,
yeah.
And she's getting her freaking second master's degree. You know, like, you know, like I said, Jim's in web development. I'm in a PhD program, so you know, at some point, even the true believers have got to leave it behind a little bit. But I'm happy that. This is the only way it's ever going to be. We're not going to do the band the way we did in our early 20s. It's just not possible. The fact that everybody has shown this commitment to keeping it going at all. I mean, if we were still doing Fortune Spirit shows 30 years from now, I swear to God, nothing would make me happier. That sounds, even if it's only a couple times a year, that would make me really happy. I don't know if it would make everybody else really happy. I don't know. Obviously, Fleming said that the emotional toll of having the band and then it going away again every time I leave is too much. And I, you know, I guess my sort of half protests of they could always find another drummer is completely on deaf ears. So they really could. Like, I would not be offended if they found another drummer. And I actually still think as the drummer, I could still find ways to contribute to the band. But they as far as I know, they haven't pursued it at all. So I don't think there's much interest in that.
Because you're also the leader.
But the thing is, I don't think I need to be the drummer to be the leader. Like, I think they think that if they replace me as the drummer, that's it for me with the band, and it doesn't have to be that way. But I get the impulse that makes them feel that way, and I'm not going to push them into it, you know. And also, it's a lot of work finding a new band member, breaking them. We've got like a 70, 80 song catalog at this point,
Which is ridiculous to think of. Trying to
bring a new member into that is just...
Yeah.
It's just too much work, I would imagine, you know. So they'd rather just hew it down to what they've got going right now and then expand it back out when I'm home. And for as long as they're willing to do that, I'm willing to do it. You know, if they're not willing to do it forever, I understand.
Mm-hmm. What else are you doing outside of, you know, getting your PhD and every once in a while, you know, playing with Fortune and Spirits? Once in a long while.
I spent the year exploring Columbus. I have an idea for a novel that I've made some very, very, very small amount of progress on while I've been here. As a PhD student, you have to produce original research, so I have a couple research projects I'm working on. I spend time with my wife. I play video games.
My wife.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I play video games. Mostly school stuff. I mean, I constantly have to be reading and
I'd imagine doing your stuff. Life is pretty dedicated to your schoolwork.
There's always something you're... Well, basically, when you're in a PhD program, there's always something you could be doing. There's always something you should be doing. And there's no way... You can't hard work yourself into elite when you're in a PhD program. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, when I went back to school, we talked about how I got thrown out of school. I ultimately went back to school starting in 2009. And even if it was a class that I didn't really understand, or if I definitely wasn't the smartest person in that class, I could always just, like, I always had this thing in my head of, like, whatever the professor asked us to do, I would do 30% more. You know, like, if they wanted 20 citations, I would have 25 citations if they wanted, which is 25% more, not 30, but whatever. you know, like, whatever it is that they asked
for. You could have fooled me, man.
Whatever it is that they asked for, I just do a little bit more, just to guarantee myself that A, you know. You can't do that anymore.
Right.
You know, I'm an elite company. I'm not the smartest person in my program. I'm probably nearer the bottom than the top. You know, there are people in that program who are smarter than me and also harder workers than I am. You know, they're willing to forego any kind of social life, you know, to further themselves academically or in their research or as teachers or whatever.
How does that make you feel? Not being surrounded by people who you think are...
Oh, incredibly insecure.
Yeah, okay.
I think, but what makes me feel good about it is that in a moment of honesty, I'll be able to get even my professors to admit, like, everybody in academia feels like a fraud all the time. We all feel like we're just waiting to be found out. Because you claim this level of expertise and authority that no other human on the planet... Like, once I'm done with this program, I will have an expertise on housing policy. You know, I will supposedly have an expertise on housing policy that maybe 150, 200 other people on this planet can match, you know, and I'm an idiot. You know, I farted in my sleep last night, you know, like, what the, you know,
it's awesome.
I'm just a dude, you know, so you feel like you're waiting to be found out, like that you're a fraud, that you don't belong there. There's no way you could possibly be smart enough to be one of those experts, you know, but everybody feels that way, even people at the top of their field.
What made you interested in housing policy?
Honestly, it was sort of a cynical calculation because, like I said before, we talked more about the group homes that I worked in, but really, for the most part, I was working as a real estate appraiser.
Right. Which is the company that your dad...
Yeah, owned. For my father and, you know, a little bit here and there for other people, too. So, like, when you plot a PhD program, you're basically trying to craft this, like, narrative about who you are, you know? And so... I was not an academic, you know. I actually was an anti-academic, you know. I'd screwed up school, you know. I didn't have a master's degree. I didn't have, like, a great career, you know. Appraising is a good job, but especially when I got into it, I started appraising full-time in 2005. It was right before the housing crash, so.
And that makes for less work, or?
We were hoping it wouldn't, but yeah, it did for a long time. Business is really only starting to pick back up now. Depending on where you are, my brother's been doing it throughout the housing crash. Been doing fine.
Okay. And he's in San Diego.
San Diego, yeah. So, how can I leverage my background for it to make sense? You know, I was just interested in policy generally. It was like, well, if I... And this actually came... The advice to do this came from the chair of the PhD department at Indiana University, which is a school I really wanted to go to. Mm-hmm. It's the number two school for what I do. You know, make my interest in policy tied into my experience as an appraiser, which was not that crazy. I mean, I really did experience the housing boom and bust firsthand.
Right.
I remember I included a story specifically in my essay about how I was doing this house near Coney Island in Brooklyn. It was this little shack of nothing. And it came in for $750,000. And, you know, I had a picture of it before I even went out. I was like, $750,000. There was no way. I wasn't stretching. I wasn't going out of my way. I wasn't finding, you know, specific data to support it. It was worth that easily.
Why? Because of location, or
I don't know. Why would a one-story 700-square-foot house in Coney Island ever be worth $750,000? Who would ever pay that much for that? Who can afford that?
Right.
Coney Island is. It's an immigrant community. It's a lower middle class community. You know, $750,000 is rich people money. You know, like, and what you realize is I was a gear in a much larger mechanism. You know, and I would ask questions all the time about, like, how can this possibly be? And it's not my place to ask that question. I'm an appraiser.
Right.
Find the data, support the value. It's either supported or it's not. It's cut and dry. It's not, but whatever, fine. And in my essay, and I really meant it, I wrote, like, I got tired of that question, those questions not mattering, you know, like, that it wasn't my job to ask those questions. I wanted it to be my job to ask those questions. So I was interested in policy generally, and housing policy is as good a place as any. And honestly, now that I'm in it, I don't regret my decision for one second. I'm really interested in it. Because really, like, we are, like, whether or not people know it, we're in a really interesting economic conversation right now. Where housing, houses, people's homes, have been the primary way that they've built wealth for 80 years now. That's the way the common man builds wealth. Most of their wealth is not in savings, it's not in stocks, it's not in 401ks or mutual funds or index funds, it's tied up in their house. That is the largest asset almost everybody owns. And people are starting to ask the question, do we need to rethink that? Is there a better way for people to build their wealth? And I don't know, but I'm really interested in that question.
And that's the just the question that you're trying to
find out. It's one of them. I mean, it's the much broader question that, of which I will address one tentacle of, probably, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of economists who are starting to make the argument, or have made the argument for a long time, that homeownership is a shell game. That homeownership as we know it today exists only because of government intervention. And they're right. Without government intervention, without Fannie and Freddie, without the mortgage interest tax write-off, without FHA, without all HUD, without all these different agencies, homeownership rates would be much, much lower than they are right now. Most of the people who own homes right now would not be able to own them.
Right.
Or they would have to have saved up a much longer time, and homeownership would be a much more elite,
mm-hmm.
elite classification.
Right. No one we know would likely...
Well, not no one, but yeah, probably a lot of the people we know wouldn't.
People.
Yeah. And there'd be a lot less home debtors, which is a term that one of the economists that I interviewed last semester used. He said that we should think of somebody as a home debtor instead of a homeowner up until the point where they have 50% equity on their house.
Yeah.
And that we should think of home ownership as a lifestyle choice, not as an investment. So if you choose to rent instead of buy, that's a lifestyle choice. And if you that shouldn't be illegitimate, and you shouldn't... There shouldn't be, because in the sense that you're incentivizing home ownership that much, you're punishing people that rent.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's an overreaction, and I think that that's the wrong way to look at it. It might be the right way to look at it from economics, that I could talk all day about all the way that economics skews the way that things people look at things. But if not that, then what?
Mm-hmm.
What would they? Why would it be better for somebody to build wealth with stocks than with a house? Because it would increase the flow of money to business? Or, I mean, I guess there's some validity to that, but you need to ask larger questions about, like, what is really the utility of the stock market? Like, what is that really doing for anybody? It gives access to money for stocks to start, but, like, why does Coke still have outstanding stocks? Why does Xerox and IBM still have outstanding stocks? Like, what do they need that for? And it's like, the answer is, well, it's just sort of a game. It's like gambling, really. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, the... Why do we have a stock market, you know? Why is that a better way to build wealth than a house? You know, the housing is a hedge in that people say you should stop thinking of it as an investment, think of it as a hedge. It's a hedge against the fact that you need shelter. So you may as well be building equity and wealth with the thing that you need shelter.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not an investment. You should just think of it as a hedge. The only utility it has to you is hedging that necessity. And I don't see why you can't think of it as both. Mine is, of course, the traditional way that we thought about homeownership. We pushed homeownership hard for decades.
Right.
And some would say that...
you mean...
The country, the government, people. Like, everybody thinks homeownership is better, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
Everybody hopes to own a home one day. So should the government stop doing that? I don't think so, but, I mean, maybe.
But what is the other option?
Yeah.
Right.
So anyway, these are sort of, I'm actually really interested in these questions, so
mm-hmm.
I'm happy to be working on them.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Since coming here, you've obviously, like, really gotten into just OSU and
yeah.
their sports teams and just, like, you know, just the culture here. In
Go
Buckeyes.
General.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you didn't have a college football team before that, so...
No one in New York does. I mean, who do you root
yeah,
for? Syracuse?
Well, because I'm Irish Catholic, I have to root for...
Notre Dame. Yeah, because
right.
you're a Whatever. Fuck Notre Dame.
The best couple of days that I've spent here, I've kind of like, I really have appreciated the kind of culture, and I haven't really interacted with a lot of people. It's just like what you're surrounded by, and just the campus and the town itself. It's very intriguing. So I can see someone being like swept up in it, but why do you, have you taken to it so quickly?
Well, I wanted to, you know, like, I've been looking for this, you know, like it's the, I mean, I never had a college team to root for, really. You know, like, Loyola had a pretty good basketball, and Loyola actually made the tournament last year.
Right.
But ultimately, Loyola was the school that kicked me out. You know, Loyola was a school that I was so depressed at that when they did kick me out, I really wasn't that upset about it. Right. You know, like, I have no ill will towards it. And in a way, I sort of owe Loyola an apology because it was nothing wrong with that school. It was my attitude, not them. But ultimately, I didn't graduate from there. I have one good friend from there. My sister went there, but I don't have much of a connection to Loyola, you know? You grow up on Long Island, it's professional sports. There's no college things, but college is such a different vibe. Like, everyone in Columbus rallies around the Buckeyes, you know? It's like a thing. It is a very, very uniting feeling, which is something completely absent from New York because we have two teams for everything, you know? And the only sport we do have one team is the Knicks, and I don't know a bunch of Knicks fans.
And we don't even have...
Oh, we have the
Nets.
Yeah,
we have the
Nets
now.
They belonged to New Jersey before, but we brought them back, I guess. It's just not... Sports is a thing, and it's fun. It's fun rivalry, but it's a thing that divides in New York. It's not a thing that unites, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, certainly.
And out here, everyone is united behind the Buckeyes, and it's like something that you have in common with everybody around you. You know, so part of the answer is, I took it because I wanted to, you know? Like, it was there for the taking, and I wanted that feeling, and I wanted to be part of something. You know, most people don't root for the team that they went to for grad school. They usually root for the team they went to for undergrad. But,
right.
You know.
You didn't have the opportunity.
Yeah, it's not even just that. It's that, it's really fun. It's fun as hell to be a Buckeyes fan, man. You know,
seems it. Yeah.
You know, we're just good enough that we're almost always in it, and we're not so good that we always win.
Right.
You know, so like, I don't know. It's really fun. I really enjoy being a part of that culture. Mm-hmm. And it's not just that. It's the Blue Jackets, too. And it's and this is even bigger than the Buckeyes for me, the Columbus Crew. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge Crew fan now. That's the MLS, the soccer team out here. And it's just – the way I describe it is it's not that dissimilar with you in hockey. When you're a hockey fan, I don't think it's like being like a football fan and a baseball fan. It feels like it belongs to you more personally. It's a much more niche thing.
Right.
And that's the way it is with like soccer. And I know as huge as it is out here, college football feels that way to me too. Or college basketball especially. You know, it feels much more niche. You know, like when I meet a Yankees fan, that's pretty exciting. But I root for this English Premier League team, the soccer team, Tottenham Hotspur. When I meet a Spurs fan, that's really exciting to me.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And when I meet a Buckeye fan outside of Columbus, that's really exciting to me, too.
Mm-hmm.
I like that I'm always going to have that. And I think it's just really fun. And I just think it's more fun to go to a college game than a pro game.
Yeah. I mean, having grown up a Giants fan, and I'm a Jets fan, it's not a great experience going to professional football games.
Especially
down
at the Meadowlands.
It's miserable. Because you're driving for a couple hours there, you get stuck in traffic there, you get stuck in traffic coming back. Most of the seats are terrible.
Yeah.
It's just a headache the entire time.
Going to a Giants game is not fun.
No.
I mean, well, it is when you're there, but everything before and after is like...
And even
when
you're
sucked
there,
into Satan's asshole. Yeah.
And here, you're a 2 mile drive away from the stadium.
Well, yeah, but you never drive to the stadium, not on game day. Yeah, so we're a 2 mile bike ride from the stadium.
Right, right.
That's the other great thing about living in Columbus. We're 2 miles from everything. You know,
yeah.
Like, there's nothing that happens in the city that really isn't like a short car ride away, which is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. What else have you started to appreciate about the town? City, excuse me.
No, you can say
it
town.
Feels like a town because I'm used to, you know, New York City.
Yeah, well, it's not as big as New York City.
Certainly not.
There is always something going on. In New York City, there's always everything going on. So in Columbus, there's always something going on.
Right.
But the difference is, it's a lot less overwhelming, and you can kind of always afford to do everything that comes up, even on my meager salary, you know? I've been to more sporting events in the past year than I had in like the 10 years before that. It's just so much cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
I can go to a Clippers game. Me and Cole can go to a Clippers game for like, a Columbus Clippers is a AAA team out here, baseball. we can go, if we spend like $40, that was kind of a lot, you know, like, go to a Yankee game, you can't spend less than $150 to $200. We can go to a Blue Jackets game for $30 or $35. We can go to a Crew game for like $20, $25, like, total, both of us, with snacks. Like, it's crazy. The same thing, all the restaurants out here are like 30% cheaper than what I'm used to.
I noticed that. And you get more.
Yeah. Too.
Like, obviously you don't drink, but, you know, ordering that beer and, you know, $5 or $6, and you're getting a, you know, 20 to 24 ounce beer. It's nice. Trust me.
We took Tim and his girlfriend Christina to a comedy show. It cost me $6.
Total.
Because I bought the tickets through the school. It's just like, you know, that wouldn't be the experience of everybody in Columbus. I get that from OSU, but like, I miss home. I miss the people from home, and I miss the location. I miss Long Island more than I thought I would, but it's really nice out here, and I really get, like, a lot of the benefits of city living without really, like, much of the hassle. I never sit in traffic. I never really have a hard time finding parking.
Right.
You know, I'm not inundated with people. I get passed by, like, homeless people and stuff, and there's a little bit of crime nearby, but, like, nothing really that bad, and it's just, like...
You've been broken. Your car has been
broken
a few times.
Mine has been broken into twice. Cole's was just broken into last week. But that was my fault. I left the car unlocked. And so somebody swiped your iPod. Right. But, you know, I mean, ultimately, it's a pretty small price to pay.
Yeah. So, you're going to find crime everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, my car got broken into twice when I was in Long Island.
Yeah.
I got my drum set.
At Island 16.
Yeah.
Twice
at Island 16. if any of these listeners are from Long Island, fucking ban Island 16. Boycott Island 16. It is the worst place in the world.
They used to work there.
What's that?
I used to work there.
And
was fucking miserable.
Yeah. So you can attest to how right I am.
Yeah.
There's plenty of movie theaters in Long Island. Just go to Stony Brook or something. They do not care about you or your possessions, or if you got stabbed in the parking lot, I don't think anyone would help you.
They would probably come out and drag your body over to the Chili's parking lot.
Yeah, this is Chili's problem now. Good people over at Wendy's will help you out.
Crap. I'm trying to think of what else I can touch on. How's married life? What's that been like?
How is married life? It is...
And be candid, because your wife is totally not in the other room.
I've been candid about everything else so far. If I lose half my friends based on this podcast, I wouldn't be shocked. Married life is amazing, honestly. Like, it's... I love being... My wife, Cole, I love her so much, and I love being married to her. I'm only a year into it, so I'm not going to make the mistake of being one of those guys that thinks he has it all figured out and marriage is easy. But so far, marriage is fucking easy. Like, I really thought it was going to be a lot. I thought there was going to be more adjustment. I thought it was going to be harder. I thought I was going to have to change a lot. And she just lets me be me, you know, and I love spending time with her. And she's like my partner and everything. And, you know, I talk to her about everything. I tell her about everything. She seems genuinely happy to see me when she comes home. Still, a year into it, you know. Year 20, if she's still happy to see me when she comes home, I'd be pretty surprised. But still, I mean, she's kept it going for this long, and I'm not an easy person to be around. You know,
like, you're rare of me too, Jesus.
I know, seriously. The marriage has been amazing, and I don't think it has anything to do with me. I think that without Cole, it would be difficult. I can imagine a lot of different scenarios where being married to me leads to a lot of fighting and a lot of trouble, and it's just not like that. You know, we fight occasionally, but it's never really been anything bad. You know.
Hitting it really quickly back to Columbus and what are the biggest things that you notice between the two places that you have lived?
Long Island and Columbus? Yeah. Well, Baltimore I lived in too.
Yeah, but we're just counting Baltimore.
Yeah, fuck Baltimore. I mean, it's not that different. Columbus feels older. You know, Long Island's a suburb. I mean, it was founded earlier, obviously, but, you know, the house that we're sitting in right now is probably built 140 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So... it feels older, a little more lived in. It feels, like I said, more united. It feels... people are generally pretty nice. I wouldn't say they're nicer than Long Island. They're not nicer than Long Island. It's a little cleaner. It's got a lot more homeless. There's no water. I mean, we have a
river. Right, yeah.
There's no ocean.
Right,
that's
I find that weird that's something that.
Yeah, I don't like the beach really. And
right.
I guess I didn't realize how much time I spend down by the ocean until I moved out here. You know, mm-hmm. I miss the food at home. Food out here is pretty good, but There's no delis. There's no everything is a much bigger to do getting food out here. Even there's this place called the North Market, which is great downtown, and they have like all kinds of different food, and it's all very, you know, locally sourced and organic and blah 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 blah. But I can't, like, getting down there, parking or taking the bus, and then getting in and getting out. It's like a hassle. Mm-hmm. I can't just stop in a deli and get food, you know. There's this place called Katzinger's Deli in German Village. It's supposed to be wonderful. I've never gone there because it's always packed to the fucking gills, you know. So, like, there's a lot of restaurants, which is nice, but there's not a lot of just get it and go kind of places.
Right.
And my life is a lot less get it and go than it used to be, which is good in a lot of ways. You know, it's nicer to live instead of constantly be driving to places where I might live, you know. Like, I drive a lot less. But, it's not the life that I had become accustomed to in Long Island. And just a bunch of these little things. When I go home and just suddenly it feels a little more right. You know, it feels like this is the way it was meant to be. For me, at least.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's different. People drive really slow.
Do they?
Really slow. There's a lot of speed traps.
Are there?
Yeah.
How many tickets have you gotten?
Just the one.
Just one?
Yeah, but...
Oh, that's good.
It was a ridiculous... I was going on one road. It goes from 45 to 35 to 25, back up to 35 in less than a mile. And that's where they caught me in the little 25 spot going... They caught me going 41 in a 25, and they hit me with like a $100 ticket. So
that's brutal.
Yeah, so I thought I was going a completely reasonable speed, but whatever. You know, it's on a four-lane road with a median, you know, going 41. Doesn't feel that
fast.
Doesn't
sound absurd, yeah.
Yeah, but there I was, my ticket.
Was there any other topics that you wanted to touch on before I moved on to my my canned questions that I have prepared for everybody?
I don't know. What else is it? Wasn't I supposed to talk about politics at some
point? You got into politics.
That's
about
true.
All right. Here's an interesting question.
Yeah, lay it on me.
Whenever I describe you to people, I say, I love talking to Matt because there aren't a lot of people who will just be painfully honest to me. I go to Matt when I need like a reality check. Where do you get that from? Or do you know where you got that from? Or what? Just why are you like that as opposed to most of the other people who might candy coat something?
I think it's a lot easier to be that way. You know, everybody would prefer to be that way. I'm just one of the assholes who just took myself up on it. Yeah. The best analogy I can use is, people really dig Ron Paul.
Uh-huh.
And, like, how honest he is, right?
Yeah.
But he's really a lot easier to be Ron Paul than it is to be Barack Obama or Mitt Romney. You know, like, they have to be... Ron Paul has the freedom of knowing he's never going to get elected. He's never going to get elected. There is a certain portion of the population that will just love him to death. But he'll never get elected to a high office. I mean, he's in the House, so he's not in a low office. But, right. You know, he's in a solidly Republican district, and he never really
has
competition.
To worry
about that. Yeah, he's got to fundraise a little bit, but he's safely in his seat, you know. I'm sure Barack Obama and Mitt Romney both wanted to be powerful politicians, and there's some amount of megalomania that goes with that. But they had to trade little bits of themselves for that. They don't get to say exactly what they think all the time. Because every time they do, someone overreacts to it or somebody cuts out just that part of it and throws it up, you know, and plays it on loop. And, you know, like, Mitt Romney said one thing about 47% one time.
Yep.
And that's going to follow him for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And he didn't mean what people made it out to be. I mean, he meant something approximating what people made it out to be, but it wasn't an evil sentiment. It was more or less right. You know, 47% of people weren't going to vote for him. You know? Bit by little bit, they both had to trade in little pieces of their integrity, little pieces of themselves that they valued, you know? They never get to be totally honest with people, at least not publicly. Ron Paul gets to say exactly what he thinks all the time. He never has to think about it because all he has to do is say what he thinks. Really easy to be that way, so I just chose the really easy way to be. Like, it's really easy to say exactly what I think, and I actually really respect the you say candy coating, which has this like pejorative,
yeah,
implication to it. But, like, really, the people that can candy coat things, the people that can be... The people that can make other people feel good while also conveying what they actually think.
They tend to be appreciated maybe a little bit more.
I just think that, I mean, that's harder.
Yeah.
That takes more tact. It takes more ability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ability to get somebody to think what you think without, like, you know, there's a way to do it just straight on and hit them and just, I will make you submit to me. Or I will do it, you know, I'll do it more subtly.
Mm-hmm.
I won't make you submit to me. I will get you to do what I want, and you'll think it was your idea.
Right.
And it sounds like I'm just, you know...
Manipulating.
Yeah, manipulating. But, you know, I manipulate people too, but I do it in a more broad, over-the-top way. So I forego... You know, I pay a cost for that. You know, you say you come to me when you want a reality check. Probably don't want a reality check a lot of times. You know,
some people don't, know.
No. No one wants it all the time, and some people don't want it ever. You know, if I was smart and if I would find a way to be kind and also tell people what I feel they need to hear. And the other thing is, I'm not the fucking final arbiter on what people need to hear. You know, I'm just one asshole floating in space like everybody else, you know,
right.
who has opinions about what's right, you know. So where it came from is probably just my family, you know, my especially my father's family. They've got an opinion about everything and everyone. Everybody's doing everything wrong, you know, and... I don't want to be that way, but I am, you know, I'm honest with people, but I think too often I'm hurtful to people in that honesty, and there's got to be a way to not be that way, and I try not to be that way, but it is what comes very naturally to me.
Right.
Well, it just happens is letting myself off the hook way too easily. You know, like, I don't, it's one of those things that I have to be constantly conscious about, otherwise it will just happen, but everybody has the ability to make themselves better if they concentrate. There's just, you know, it's a lot less energy to not concentrate. So why I'm that way, I think, is because it's easier, honestly. And I think that, you know, I think my family grew up dropping truth bombs on everybody.
Dropping education.
Yeah, so I'm going to drop some science on a motherfucker and be like, yeah, let me tell you the ways that what you're doing is not the right thing. And, which sometimes people do need, but I probably give it to people that don't need it too. So it's about finding a balance. So I feel like you led into this by trying to compliment me, but I refuse to accept it because it is not one of my favorite parts of my personality.
I know. It is one of my favorite parts of your personality, though.
I'm sure I've hurt your feelings multiple times by telling you the truth.
I can't remember that a single time. Oh, shit, I can't remember a single time. I'm sure you have, but...
You're trying to be gracious.
I'm trying to be a good host. Number one favorite album of all time.
My number one favorite album of all time is an album called Donuts by J Dilla, which is... it's like 30 tracks, and they're about a minute and a half each. And it's just beats that he's working on. For rappers, but there's no flow over them, and it really, like, I was already sort of into like Motown and stuff like that, but it really kickstarted my love of like old school soul, and his beats are just unbelievable. They, you know, I'm not trying to be that white guy who's like pretentiously into rap. Like, I don't, rap is not my favorite kind of music, but J Dilla is just on a whole nother level, and he actually, I just said a whole nother. Another whole level. I hate when people say a whole nother.
A whole nother level.
He was dying while he worked on it. He died not long after it came out. And it's like, there's another album that came out a couple years ago. This guy named Ali Farka Touré. He died while he was working on the album too. And like, they were both aware that they were dying as they worked on it. So like, you know, maybe I'm just projecting into it, but it's just, it reads like, and especially the J Dilla album, it reads this like beautiful sort of like, it's the sound of somebody dying, but it's not dark at all. It's mm-hmm. just like
swan song, right?
It's just like
that would be the term.
Bye, I'll see you soon.
Yeah,
like, you know, it's, you know, it's I love that album. That's my favorite. You know, I Abbey Road is one of my favorite albums. Mm-hmm. The self-titled album by this band called Broken Social Scene is one of my favorite albums. You know, I have tons of favorite. That's
all over the place. Yeah,
that album is my favorite album. It's not a song on that album I don't like.
What's in your car trunk right now?
My truck is always full of shit. There's a jack in there, drum stuff, forever drum hardware.
Forever drum stuff, even though you never play here.
Yeah, sticks, tools. You know, I wanted to ask you about this. Has this trunk question worked out the way you hoped it would?
No, not even a little.
I was trying to think of, like, I wanted to give you a suggestion, because I think the question about the trunk is meant to get at something that the person doesn't necessarily wouldn't consciously reveal on their own,
mm-hmm.
but
it's not doing that.
It's not an expected question, but I just don't think most people have something interesting in their trunk.
Right.
And I'm not so sure that what people have in their trunk reflects anything about them. But I think it was an interesting suggestion. The notion of the question is a lot more interesting than the question itself, I think. And I'm trying to think of, like, what's a better question to ask that would get...
That can get that kind of reveal.
Yeah.
It's hard. Like I said in the first episode, it's a work in progress. I've never done this before. So I'm still trying to feel out how to make this a very good podcast as opposed to just a semi-enjoyable one.
I think one of my favorite questions to ask people is, tell me something that you're sure about. And then, once they say it, how do you know that?
I like that one.
That's one of my favorite questions to people. How do you know that?
All right, what are you something you're sure about?
What is something that I'm sure about? That...
Boom, just blew your mind.
The Beatles are better than the Rolling Stones.
What makes you so sure?
Because since those two bands have come out, all of mankind has basically heard those two bands and has entered into, like, this sort of intersubjective negotiation about, like, what good music is. And, you know, like, the Beatles have had this unbelievable stain, you know, like, this band that only existed for, like, you know, 8 years, only really existed in the public imagination for 6, continues. And the Rolling Stones don't, like... It's really interesting.
The Rolling Stones, a band that's still around.
I mean, they're around and they make a lot of money, but I mean,
yeah.
What hits people where they live more? Brown Sugar or Yesterday? You know, like,
mm-hmm.
like it, and it really and it dovetails with that. You know, with the question from High Fidelity, is better to burn out or fade away? You know, mm-hmm. it's probably better to burn out. You know, like, I just think that the Beatles have united music fandom in a way that no other band ever has and might not ever again. And I think the Rolling Stones were a lot of swagger and they were a lot of piss and vinegar and booze. And I think that when that ages, it's a lot less attractive than just good music.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the Rolling Stones are not bad, but they're,
not as good as the Beatles.
But the thing, and the deeper question you get to is what's good? And is everybody's opinion equally valid? And the answer is, I know what good is, but I couldn't describe it to you. And no, not everyone's opinion is equally valid. Like, it really is, like, you know, like, because that's the nuclear bomb you can always drop in one of those conversations. Like, which better, this band or this band?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's my opinion, man. It's like, you know, everyone is entitled to their own opinion, of course. But, like, and good is this, like, very nebulous in the ether kind of concept. And you never hone in on it, but you do. Like, we discuss it and we agree. You know, like, it's a question of aesthetics. And no, there's no solid objective answer, but I don't think there's a solid objective answer to everything. There's only sort of negotiation and intersubjective agreement about what good is. You know, you and I hash it out and we discuss it, and whatever sort of quorum we achieve at the end of that is what's good. And that stands until we have the new definition, and that challenges the old definition, and on and on and on, and it never ends. And, you know, did you study Plato at all in college?
I was barely paying attention during the lesson.
It was the forms of Plato. There's this idea that there's this perfect notion of everything in the heavens, and achieving truth is digging deeper and deeper and deeper until we get closer to that perfect form. So it means that there's a right answer from the outset. And it's just a matter of how close can you get to that right answer. And I don't believe that at all. I don't think that there is a right answer. I think there's only the argument. And the argument is what matters. And whatever you settle on in the argument, or whatever you don't settle on in the argument, is the truth. And it's provisional, and it's changed, and it changes. It's subject to renegotiation. But that is that there is no perfect godly given. There's no perfect version of this laptop. There's no perfect version of Tim. There's no perfect version of food. There's only the negotiation. I really believe that. And just, I think that in the negotiation, the Beatles have come out on top. And I don't think it's invalid for somebody to like the Rolling Stones more than the Beatles, but I think that the intersubjective negotiation of mankind is such that the Beatles have come out on top. The Beatles are better than the Rolling Stones.
Well, that was a very interesting explanation.
I really believe that. What the thing is, though, that that's such a controversial notion to people.
It really is, yeah.
Because it's very disempowering to somebody who has the minority opinion. But it doesn't have to be that way. You know, things change all the time. You know what's a really good example of that? Wade Boggs is a really good example of that. His stats didn't change, but the perception of him changed as on-base percentage became the go-to metric over batting average.
Right.
Because he spent his entire life batting second and getting on base. He never hit a ton of home runs. He had a good batting average, but he wasn't Ted Williams. Mm-hmm. And then bit by little bit, Wade Boggs got better and better and better, even though he had stopped playing. And that's insane. How does somebody get better after they stop playing? But he did. Like, he... In retrospect, he was a better player than any of us knew at the time, mm-hmm. you know? So even something that's locked in stone, he'll never have another hit in the major leagues. He'll never have another bat in the major leagues. He's done. Wade Boggs is done. And yet the verdict on him keeps changing. Or look at, like, what Amadeus did to Mozart, you know, in the 80s. Like, all of a sudden, the idea of Mozart completely changed from just another composer, you know, albeit a very famous composer, a very popular composer, to, like, this, like, tortured genius, which was usually the story of Beethoven, not Mozart, you know? And, these things keep changing, and history keeps reevaluating. You know, the more we learn about Shakespeare, the more we learn that he was, like, a plagiarist and mm-hmm. kind of a gay tax evader, like, evil man. Like, you know, like, it might not have even existed, you know? Like, it's just funny the way that, like, these things that we think of as facts and as objective and as history, they never stop.
Right.
You know? Yeah. I just think that's really interesting.
All right. Well, Matt, that's all the questions I have for you.
I think I've said plenty.
Anything to interject? All right, fair. It's been a pleasure having you on, and thank you for your hospitality.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks for coming.
It was awesome seeing you. Oh. We had an awesome time in Columbus.
You just dominated me.
What do you mean?
Okay, so we shook hands, right?
Yes.
And you turned your wrist a little bit this way, mm-hmm. and we shook hands. He turned his wrist in so that his hand was on top of mine. Which means psychologically that you dominated me.
If
you ever want to dominate me, you now have the psychological evidence that you can do that whenever you want.
Goddamn straight.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again for being on, and I'll talk to you soon.
Love to be here, man. Thanks.
All right, guys, that was my interview with Matt Record. It was certainly an awesome experience sitting down and talking to him and just being in Columbus. Was great, really fantastic city. Thanks again, Matt, for being such a great host, and I'll catch you guys next week. All right, just.